We turn this evening once again to the Gospel of Matthew. I say once again because over the past several Wednesday evenings we've been looking at certain statements in the Gospel, and for the past few Wednesdays we've been looking in the Gospel of Matthew. Last Wednesday, you might recall, we were in chapter 17 and we were listening to the words of Peter on the Mount of Transfiguration, when he said, "It is good for us to be here." And we were looking at the context, why he said it, what he saw and heard. And we were trying to draw some lessons from that rather succinct statement. We've been looking at single verses, pregnant statements in the Gospels that teach so much in so small a compass. And we're going to come this evening to Matthew's Gospel in chapter 8. And we're going to look once again at something that Jesus said on a certain occasion. You remember a few weeks ago we saw Jesus reminding us, then comes the end, you remember. So we're looking at these little isolated, in a sense isolated statements. And of course the verse I want to draw our attention to this evening is in Matthew chapter 8 and at verse number 10. Where in the context, we're going to look at the context, of course, and see why Jesus says what he does say. But our interest this evening is not to, as it were, unravel the whole of this narrative of the Roman centurion pleading with Jesus for his sick servant. Our interest this evening is rather in what Jesus says concerning this Roman centurion. And he says in verse number 10, he said to those who had heard him, he is responding, of course, to something that the Roman centurion has done and said. And indeed, as we know from the Gospel of Luke, chapter 7, where we also have this narrative, what others have said concerning this Roman centurion. And Jesus, in response, says to those who were listening to him, following him, truly I say unto you, I have not found so great faith, no, not in Israel. Now, there's something obviously rather peculiar and unique about the Roman centurion that makes Jesus speak as he does. The only other place where we have this narrative is in the Gospel of Luke that we were reading in chapter 7. And once again, Luke and Matthew recording the same thing. They don't record it in the same way. Matthew gives little details that Luke omits, and Luke gives actually more details that are omitted by Matthew. But we're going to take Matthew's account just as a convenience, really. We could have taken it out of Luke because the Lord says essentially the same thing. But we want to notice, first of all, that we're told here that Jesus uttered these words when he was marveling. Jesus marveled, we're told. And this word marvel means, it's translated in other places, but at times it means taken by surprise. Something is unusual about this. It's something that causes a comment because there's something rather strange taking place. We find that people marveled, for example, at Jesus when he was performing his signs and wonders. And in the Old Testament, we find that there's quite a number of places where the words and the works of God, they caused people to marvel and to wonder at what was taking place. And they made comment about it. And that's the idea that we have here. And the interesting thing about this is, apart from the Gospel of Luke, chapter 7, where, as we see, Luke records the same thing, there is only one other place in the Gospels. There are two incidents in the Gospel records where Jesus marveled. There is the incident of the Roman centurion, where he marveled at the faith of the Roman centurion and said that he had never found so great faith, not in the whole of Israel. The other place where Jesus marveled is in the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 6, at verse number 6, where he marveled at their unbelief. So the two occasions where Jesus marveled is at the extraordinary unbelief one would have expected in the Gospel of Mark, because it's when he was coming to his own city, his own town. These people knew him. They knew him well. They'd heard him preaching. And despite what he had done and said amongst them, they didn't believe. And he could do no mighty miracles among them. And he marveled at their unbelief. It was unexpected. You would have thought that by the time these people had really faced up to the issues of what Jesus was saying, that they would have been willingly embracing him and in faith submitting to him. But there was a resistance, there was a rejection, there was an entrenched hostility. Jesus recognized that a prophet is not without honor, except among his own familiar family and friends. And these people were too familiar. They were just over familiar with Jesus. They ought not to have been in the awful unbelief. And so Jesus marveled, because there was something very strange. Because wherever else Jesus went, we find that people, yes, there were always those who resisted, but there were always those who believed. But it seems that in Nazareth there was a strange hostility and an entrenched unbelief. And so Jesus marveled, because they ought not to have been in unbelief. And here he is marveling at the faith of the Roman centurion, because he's finding faith in a most unusual place and in a most unusual individual. And that is what is so remarkable, because this is a one-off situation. And there are things said, especially in the Gospel of Luke, about this Roman centurion and in the two narratives in Matthew and Luke, that point to something quite unique and extraordinary that caused Jesus to speak as he does. Now, when we have this high, and indeed it is the greatest accolade that Jesus gives concerning faith in all the gospel records, he doesn't speak of anybody else like this. He has never found so great faith. This Roman centurion is being singled out as being the man, up to this point at least, whom Jesus come across, and he has greater faith than anybody else that Jesus has ever met. And this is worthy of our attention, because it raises the question, what is it about this man that makes Jesus speak of him in this way? And if indeed this is how Jesus evaluates great faith, then we have to examine our faith and see how we fit into the faith of this Roman. Because there are certain ingredients, there are certain things specifically said about this Roman soldier that are the basis as to why Jesus says he's got great faith. And if you and I are going to have great faith, then we've got to have the same ingredients. Because Jesus is saying the characteristics that mark out this man are the characteristics that evidence faith that is not just limping and barely existing, but strong faith. And so we have to ask the question, well, what is it about this Roman that makes Jesus speak of him in such a high and such an approving manner? I have not found so great faith, because wherever Jesus went, as we know, he wanted faith. He wanted people to believe in him. And when he says great faith, he means faith in himself, as we're going to see towards the end of the sermon. And so there are some ingredients here which they lie on the surface. There's nothing mysterious about it, because Matthew and Luke, they in fact tell us the details by which we can say, well, that's the reason why Jesus speaks of this man as having great faith. What are these things? Well, the first thing is love. Faith and love always go together. You can't have one without the other. And there are two areas in which the love of this Roman centurion is quite evident. First of all, it is love towards his dying slave. You see, here is a man, he is a Roman officer in the Roman army of occupation. We'll come back to that later. And as a rule, Roman centurions, they were rather tough characters. They were used to the rougher side of life. They were used to bloodshed, and they were promoted from the ranks because they were actually very competent as soldiers, and that meant the brutalities of ancient warfare. So here was a man who was no stranger to the rough and the tumble of military life, and indeed of an occupation army. And yet there was something different about this man. There's something that's very tender at somewhere along the line. We don't know the details of the spiritual or moral history of this Roman soldier. But we do know that he had come to a point where he was tender of heart and where he was regarding his slave, his, on the one hand, his doulos. Luke tells us that he was a slave, a bond slave. And he was dying. He was near unto death. Matthew doesn't say. He just was sick. But it is Luke who says this slave was not going to survive. He was actually dying. And unless Jesus would intervene, this man was going to die. So here is a Roman, and he doesn't regard this particular servant or slave in his household simply as property. He regards him as a person. And he regards him as a very dear person to him. He regards him as precious, not as a property, but almost as his own child, because the language that is used in the original, this servant is described in two different words. The word doulos, which means slave or servant, but also the word pais, which means child or son or boy. So here is a Roman, he owns this slave, but he regards him almost as if he were his own son, so attached is he. He loves this slave. Now this is unusual, because this is the only place in the entire Gospels where we find anybody coming to Jesus and making a petition on behalf of a slave. We find people coming and asking Jesus for their own health. We find them asking for their friends. We find them asking for their families, but here is a man, and his whole concern, and so concerned is he, and so affectionately attached to his servant, his son, is he that he sends elders of the church, the elders of Israel, and then it seems he comes himself. Because there are those who say, well, here in Matthew's Gospel, we're told that he came to Jesus. Whereas in Luke's Gospel, we're told that he sent elders of the synagogue. And there are those who say, well, here's a contradiction. There's no contradiction. The man sent elders to Jesus, and the man came himself to Jesus, just to ensure that Jesus was informed, and Jesus was invited to come. Please come. Indeed, he says, you don't even need to come. All you need to do is just say a word, and my servant is going to be healed. But here is a Roman soldier who is a man whose heart has been touched towards slaves. That in itself is unusual, because even the ancient Greeks who wrote about these ethical issues, they said that slaves were property. And yes, you would preserve the life of a slave if he was worth something. And there are those who might say, well, this slave was precious. He was a young man in fullness of health. That is the way that some people would argue, but that is not true to the character of this Roman soldier. And so when I say love, I mean that this man has a heart that has been touched, and he is compassionate and he is sympathetic for his servant. He's not asking anything for himself. He's asking something for his servant. So he loves his servant. He loves those who are obviously of an inferior class to that to which he himself belongs as an officer in the Roman army. So that's one area of love. But in Luke's Gospel, we're told of another area of love. And that is when the Jewish elders came to Jesus, they said, he is worthy that you should do this thing for us, that you should do this thing for him, because he loves our nation, and he has built us a synagogue. And so the other area of love of this Roman officer is that he loves the Jews. He loves the Jewish people. Now the Jewish people are an oppressed people. They are an inferior people. They are occupied. He belongs to the ruling class. The Jewish people were regarded by and large by Romans as nothing but a troublesome people. The Roman province of Judea was not a place that the Roman army wanted to be posted to, because it was dangerous, it was troublesome, it was not a safe and calm billet. The Jews, they just would not fit into the Roman Empire in the way that many other nations would. They were always troublesome. They had these strange laws, Sabbath keeping and such like thing. And they worshipped a god that no one had ever seen. And every other nation, they had their idols, and the Romans could handle that, but they could never handle the Jews. And so there was a deep anti-Semitism in the Roman Empire. And it was part of the culture of this man's society and the class to which he belonged that they hated the Jews. And they couldn't get out of Judea quick enough, quite frankly. But here is a Roman again, and he's different. Because he loves our nation. And that means, you see, he loves our nation because he loves us as a people. He is recognizing there is something about us that's different. What is it about the Jewish nation that makes people, even to this day, love the Jewish nation? It's because we love their God. Why would this Roman soldier go to any bother to build a synagogue for the Jews unless he himself believed in the God of Israel? And unless he loved the God of Israel? And love and faith always go together. You can't believe in God without loving him. You can't believe in God without loving your neighbor as yourself. You can't believe in God really without even loving your enemies. And everything about this man is expressive of faith that is working by love. And so when Jesus is giving him this approbation, it's because here is a man. He certainly does love. And he loves the God of Israel. And he loves the people of Israel because they are the people of this God. This man has become a God-fearer, and this man is one. And the Jewish people who recognized that they were oppressed, who hated the Romans, just as much as the Romans hated them. And here are the Jewish leaders in the synagogue in Capernaum, and they're saying, this Roman, he is worse that you should do this good thing for him. That was most unusual. You see, love breaks down the barriers. Christian love, spiritual love, the kind of love that always accompanies true faith. It doesn't, as it were, just simply believe in isolate. Faith always works by love. And it is what this man is doing that actually causes Jesus to speak of him. He hasn't had any great conversation with the man. The man hasn't spoken to him of the details of theology. He hasn't, as it were, discussed Jesus, the intricacies of Jesus' mission. He simply obviously has heard about Jesus. And Jesus perhaps has never kind of come across this man before, even although he was in and out of Capernaum quite a lot, as we know it was a garrison town. And yet what he knows about this man is quite sufficient, because Jesus recognizes that love ultimately is the primary grace. And we can have faith that will remove mountains. We can have faith. We can have all kinds of faith that believes everything. But unless we love our neighbor, and unless we love God's people, our faith is nothing but a sterile confession to creeds and remains within the strictures of some kind of ecclesiastical confession. Nothing more than that. So when Jesus says, this man, I have not found so great faith, it is because of the love, the sheer love that comes out of the life of this Roman centurion. He loves our nation. But the second thing is the works of this Roman centurion. Not just love, but faith works by love. Bishop Ryle, in his inimitable way, comments on this Roman centurion. And he says, here is a man, he loves his servant, but he doesn't stand wringing his hands. He doesn't stand weeping over the dying, the deathbed of his servant. He does what he can. He is up and doing. And there is a time for us to pray. There is a time for us to weep. We know that. The Bible says there's a time for everything. But there's also a time to stop weeping and to stop praying and start doing something about it. And this man, whatever else we may think of him, in the two areas of love, he actually expresses his love for his servant, because he does what he can for his servant. He can't do anything for his servant. But he knows that there's a man called Jesus who seems to be able to do marvelous things. He's healed other people. And here is a Roman centurion who believes this man, if he will come, if he is willing, he can come and he can even speak a word. Simply speak a word, and my servant will be healed. Now that is a tremendous confession of faith. Because here is a man who recognizes that Jesus doesn't even need to be present in order to perform a miracle of healing. And so he does what he can for his servant. And in doing what he can, he sends for Jesus and then comes to Jesus. He puts himself out of his way. He inconveniences himself, as we would say. He does something about it. And works always, always express the reality of our love and our faith. Faith without works is dead, in the same way as faith without love is dead. But not only does he do something, he does what he can for his servant, but he also does what he can for the Jewish people. He builds them a church. And when it says here that he has built us a synagogue, the implication is he paid for it. Now we have no idea, I have no idea what it would cost to build a church, to build a synagogue, but I dare say that the building costs would not be negligible. And indeed the archaeologists, as you probably know, they have found the foundation of quite a sizable, what they think is a synagogue in what they think was the old town of Capernaum. And if in fact it is the same synagogue that is referred to, it was a fairly sizable church, not as big as this building here, but nonetheless, as far as synagogues go, it was a sizable gathering place for the Jewish people. Now, why would a Roman soldier wish to do that kind of thing? Unless he were willing to identify himself publicly with the people of Israel. Here was a man who did not keep his faith and his love towards the God of Israel and the people of Israel a secret. He was, as it were, nailing his colors to the mast. He was wearing his religion on his sleeves. His fellow officers in the Roman army would know perfectly well what he was up to and where he would be associating. When he was willing to worship with people, where would he worship? Even Gentiles, they could go into the synagogue. There were places in the temple they couldn't go, but they could go into the synagogues. And there's no question, surely, that here is a man who would, as it were, identify publicly with the public worship of the Jews. And that would be a tremendous thing, because it would mean this. It would mean that here is a Roman officer who publicly is turning his back upon the old Roman religion. He is no longer worshipping with his other fellow soldiers in the legion at the temple of Mithras or some other legionary god or whatever. He is worshipping the God of Israel. And he is doing so with great expenditure. He is generous in his support of the public religion of Israel. And everything about this man, therefore, is a display of a converted man. Here is a man who has been converted to Jehovah. And that's not an unusual thing for Gentiles in the gospel narratives. Indeed, as I've mentioned before, Roman centurions as a whole come out fairly well in the New Testament records. They seem to be, on balance, a fair-minded class of men. And certainly here is one from this unlikely source. We don't know what nation he came from. Bishop Ryle again goes into these kinds of things. We don't know how old he was. Probably a man in his 40s, perhaps approaching 50, a mature Roman officer. He certainly would be no chicken because you didn't reach centurion rank until you had proved yourself over a considerable length of time. So here is a mature man who has come to mature decisions. This is not some young fellow going through these religious phases that many people go through and then they grow out of it again. Here is a man of a settled character who is willing to commit himself to the occupied people of Israel. And indeed, like Moses, in a certain sense, identify with a slave nation. That's the kind of thing. Works, you see, are often costly. And it wouldn't be easy for this Roman soldier to make up his mind to fork out the money and then see it through to the end to build a synagogue. It's not easy. Sometimes we can be enthusiastic about some spiritual project that we have our mind set on in a religious mood or a religious moment. But here is a man who saw it through. Buildings don't grow up overnight. He has built for us a synagogue. And like Moses and like all the others of whom we read in the Epistle to the Hebrews in chapter 11, they all did something that was difficult. Here was a man who was standing out like a sore thumb among his fellow soldiers. And there's no question that they'll be commenting on him. What makes, whatever his name is, what makes him believe in the God of these oppressed people? That kind of thing. Now, you might say, well, that's pure imagination. Yes, it is. But it's realistic. That's the kind of thing that happens when you stand out like a sore thumb in the way that this Roman soldier evidently stands out. And he actually wins the approval rather than the cursing and the hatred of the oppressed nation of Israel. It was the elders of Israel speaking on behalf of their thankful community, saying to Jesus, he is worthy that you should do this because he has committed himself to us and built for us a synagogue. That was an unusual thing. If you and I were not the adherents of some religion, would you build a mosque unless you were in some way committed to the religion of the mosque? Would you build some kind of temple for the Mormons or for whatever unless in some way you had more than a passing sympathy? This is a man who is committed. And he is committed not just by believing and by loving, but by doing. His works show. And as it is in the Epistle to the Hebrews, by faith, Abraham, by faith, they all did something by faith. This man could be written in the annals of Hebrews chapter 11. The Roman centurion, by faith, he built the Jews a synagogue. And it would fit into the kind of narrative that we have in Hebrews chapter 11. And he built the synagogue because he loves our nation. But it's not only love to his servant, and love to the Jews, and love that evidences itself in doing what he can for his servant, and doing what he can for the Jewish people with whom he has contact. But there is also faith, and it is evidently faith in Jesus Christ. Taking the two narratives together, Matthew and Luke, we find that it is evident that the Roman centurion has heard something about Jesus. He may well have seen him. We don't know. He may have heard reports firsthand of people who had heard and seen Jesus. But whatever it is, faith comes by hearing, and hearing comes by the word of God and by the works of God too. And so here was a man who knew enough about Jesus to know that the kind of authority that Jesus had was even superior to the kind of authority that he has. You see, he is a Roman officer. He is a man of substance. He is a man of importance. He is a man who, when he would walk down the street, the Roman soldiers would raise their hands in salute. And the Jewish suppressed people, they would stand aside to let him pass. He was the man who would march at the head of his troops, evidently wearing the accoutrements and the rank badges of his position in the army. He was a man who was used to authority. And he would say to servants, do this, and they would do it. And to soldiers, come and go, and they would do it. Because he was a man, he had the authority of Caesar, and his commission was given to him by the supreme emperor in Rome, and he was given charge, and he would command that it would be done. But what he says about himself and what he says about Jesus is rather interesting. He says to Jesus, I also am a man under authority. And he tells how his authority is worked out. And what he says is, Jesus, I recognize that you are also a man under authority. You too are exercising a given authority. I have someone over me, the emperor. And he is able to command me to command my servants and my soldiers, and they will do it. But you have a higher authority. You have the authority from your master to be able to heal the sick. He maybe has heard of how Jesus could raise people from the dead. We don't know. But I, too, am a man under authority. And all you need to do is do the kind of thing that I do. I just say, do it, and it's done. All you need to do is say, do it, and it's done. And you are given an authority that is actually supreme, superior to my authority. In other words, here is a man, a Roman officer, and he is saying to a Jewish carpenter, a man from Nazareth of all places, a Galilean, and he is saying to Jesus, you are higher in authority than I am. He is saying to Jesus, I am not worthy that you should come under my roof. In other words, I am not superior enough to have you as my guest. You are higher than I am. That is a tremendous thing. He calls Jesus Lord. That is not just a polite title. It is a title for the Messiah. Now, what is this Roman authority? What is this Roman saying? He is saying to Jesus, I know who you are. I recognize you. Because I know enough about the Jewish religion to know what their scriptures say about the Messiah. The Messiah, when he comes, he's going to be able to perform certain signs and wonders. He is going to bring a light to the Gentiles as well as to the Jews. The people that sit in darkness are going to see a great light. And as far as this Roman officer is concerned, Jesus exactly fits the biblical description of the coming one. He is receiving Jesus as his Savior and Messiah. Lord, he says. And he comes to Jesus. And he came beseeching him. There's no command here. There's no superior attitude. It is one in which faith comes to Jesus, believing implicitly that Jesus is whom the scriptures speak as the Messiah of God. And that's why Jesus says, not in Israel. Jesus went primarily to the lost sheep of the house of Israel, as we know. Gentiles were brought in. We think of the Syrophoenician woman. We can think of the Roman soldiers who came to the baptism of John the Baptist. And they also were spoken to by John the Baptist. And so the Gentiles were included, but they were in the fringe. But here is a Gentile belonging to the fringe. And Jesus says, he is the most eminent example of faith I've ever found so far. You won't get an Israelite believing like this man. Because despite all the disadvantages of his background as a Gentile, a Roman, a soldier of all things, he still has come to a point, the kind of place that Jesus desires people to come to. And when he went out and among the Jews, the lost sheep of the tribe of Israel, he was finding arguments from the religious establishment. He was finding opposition. He was finding, yes, believers, but they weren't the majority. And so amidst all the unbelief and those who believed him, this Roman soldier comes and he's the best of them all. And if you and I are going to have Jesus' accolade that our faith is great, it means that without demur, with a measure of true humility, we recognize that Jesus is the final word, the final work. We don't try to argue about him. We don't try to go beyond what we know. We simply submit. We beseech him. And we recognize that in comparison to him, we are very, very inferior. We are not worthy to have him. You see, sometimes the gospel is presented to the world. Will you have Jesus? Will you receive him? Now that is, in a sense, a biblical perspective. But it's not the most important biblical perspective at all. The question really should be, will Jesus have us? It's not, will I have him, but will he have me? And when you and I come and make up our mind about Jesus, we are beseeching him to make up his mind about us, to receive us, and to help us, because we need him more than he needs us. So there is the love of the Roman centurion. There is the works of the Roman centurion. There is the basic belief of the Roman centurion. And then we've already begun to touch on it. There is the humility of the Roman centurion. A Roman to a Jew, a Roman officer to a carpenter. try to envisage the contrast, the sheer it would be unthinkable. It would be unthinkable in the context of the time. It would be unheard of that any Roman officer would say to a Jewish carpenter from Nazareth, "Lord, Master, you are greater than I. I am not worthy of your company." That is extraordinary. Here is a man who is thankful that Jesus would even listen to him. And I think that we need to grasp this humility, because I think we're too proud. I think we're too confident. I think there is a certain kind of inbuilt arrogance that's very hard to get out of us. One of the marks of sin is pride. And even in the state of grace, we're still in a state of sin too. We're still in the flesh, even when we're in the spirit. And it could be that pride is one of those marks of our fallenness that is perhaps one of the most difficult for us to deal with and to suppress and mortify, in the words of the Puritans. The mortification of pride. I've still got my pride. When everything else goes, I've still got my pride at the end of the day. Here is a Roman centurion who, before the needs of the Jewish people, he had no pride. Before the needs of his own servant, he had no pride. Before the presence and the power and the authority of Jesus, he had no pride. He is taking the lowest place in every single relationship, you see. He is always seeking the good of others or the authority of others. In other words, he is humbling himself. Humility is a beautiful virtue, sometimes hard to see, sometimes hard to find in our own hearts. Certainly very difficult to find in the world and very difficult to find in the church. But here is a man, and if anything marks him out, it's not only love and activity and faith, but it is humility. And he comes down, as it were, of his high horse. He may well have been wearing his Roman uniform with all its badges of rank. He may have been an impressive figure. But before the wandering carpenter, he was taking a lowly place because he recognized that Jesus is the Lord and that he is dependent upon Jesus in a way that Jesus is not dependent upon him whatsoever. And Jesus complies with the request. He speaks the word. The servants went back. The man went back to his house and he found that his servant was healed. His faith was vindicated. Because Jesus is pleased with such faith as this. This is great faith, you see. Now, this is not what the world recognizes as great faith, or sometimes even what the church recognizes as great faith. And I say that because we are too prone to think that great faith means great understanding, great ability in debate, great preaching, great sermons, running a great church, able to influence a great many people, or whatever. We think that must be great faith. Because we read our history books and we read of all these heroes who have done all these marvelous things by faith. And we think that great faith surely is to be a mighty man in some way. No, great faith is to be like this Roman. Loving, working, believing, and self-humbling. That's what Jesus says great faith does. And that's why he says, "I have not found so great faith." Not in Israel. And so the question for you and for me is this, because Jesus does have an opinion of all of us, just as we all have an opinion on each other and on ourselves. This Roman said, "I'm not worthy." The Jewish people said, "He is worthy." Jesus says, "You've got great faith." So what does Jesus say about us? Does he say concerning me and concerning you, "Oh, great faith"? Does he say that of us? And if he does, where are the evidences upon which he says it? And if perhaps these evidences are not there, does he think we are of great faith? If we're unloving, not working, not believing, and not self-humbling. Jesus marveled. This is a most unique individual. And as far as we know, there's nobody quite like it. In the entire gospel record, there's nobody quite like this. according to Jesus. May God bless his work to us.